40 plus years ago, when I was a student, I shared a room in Methodist International House in Birmingham with my friend Keith. There are all sorts of reasons why I can properly describe him as my friend, but one in particular, very distinctive, was this. His dad worked for Fry's in Keynsham. Now, for those of you who aren't old enough, Fry's was an ancient chocolate maker, which was eventually bought out by Cadbury's, which disappeared under the label of Kraft. But in those days, there was still a Fry's, but part of Cadbury's. And every time Keith came back from a visit home, he always came back with chocolate supplies from the factory shop at Keynsham. He returned with Fry's chocolate cream, one of my all-time favourites. First made, do you know? Any idea when Fry's chocolate cream was first made? Actually, that's very close, Matt. It was 1866. Is it still around? I haven't seen it recently. Oh, I'm not so struck on that. I like the chocolate cream one. Anyway, there was always some Fry's chocolate cream, always some crunchy. Another all-time favourite. Turkish Delight. And then by this time, there were also Cadbury products. Dairy Milk Bars. Bourneville. Fruit and Nut. Another all-time favourite. And a number of others whose names I've now forgotten. And if I start asking you to tell me, we'll be here all morning. Although, Wikipedia says that Fry's produced more than 220 different chocolate bars in their time. Which is more than I would have thought. The key evidence of friendship was this, though. When Keith returned, all the chocolate was shared out because everything came in twos. Now, I can't actually clearly remember whether the collection was divided there and then, one for you, one for me, one for you, one for me, or whether actually it was all stored away in a cupboard and Keith might say, "What do you fancy today?" I think it was probably the latter. If it was, it was definitely another example of his favourite because it was more to my benefit. Because let's be honest, if he'd split them in half, his half would always have lasted longer than mine. And that would have been an extreme pressure upon me. But you see, as far as I'm concerned, we would agree what we were going to enjoy together and then we'd have one each. I'm not actually sure whether his dad deliberately said, "These are for Graham and these are for you, Keith." I can't remember that, but what I do know is that however it was stated on the way between Bristol and Birmingham, it didn't all go into Keith's side, as far as I'm aware. It finished up two equal packages from my friend Keith. Now, well, do some of you this morning have some benefits? You can tell the rest of us of some benefits of friendship that you can recall. Something where you've had a benefit because you had a friend with you. Or you had a long-term friend. Don't be shy. You might need to run around with a microphone, Janet. Alison's got one. We might as well have it on for the benefit of those listening later. She's taken hold of it. That's dangerous. Good.
And Dad used to take me on holiday with them.
Excellent. Now that's a great example. Yeah. One there. Christine, would you believe? Do you know what? Christine's mum used to take Alison on holiday.
Well, yeah. So because of that, I had somebody to do things with on holiday when my mum and dad didn't want to. But also because Alison and Phil are our friends, Jacob and Zach have had holidays that we wouldn't have been able to give them.
Right.
So our children have benefited from our friendship too.
Brilliant. And actually, Phil went with Dave to fetch Jacob back from Albania. Ronnie.
Well, I still meet twice a year with about six.
I thought for a minute you were going to say you had a match. I'd rather have the meal, to be honest.
Mine are walking.
Yeah, we...
Sharing waves with Adrian.
Okay.
And screaming at them as we come down to land.
And you're still doing that?
Well, we haven't done it for a few years. We haven't been formal together.
Okay. Okay. Well done, John.
I've got a friend who laughs at my jokes.
Really? That is a friend.
I think that's our friend.
Yeah. Well, that's good news, that is. We can just take one more.
I've got a friend who, when I ran out of stocks, bought me a new pack of five.
Really?
Stocks when I ran out.
Well, that's impressive, that is. Is that...
I just mentioned it, and then the next day, they turned up.
Wow, amazing. I heard... I must admit, I did hear a church leader talking on Tuesday morning, and he was saying, he just mentioned that he fancied a mini iPad, and the next week one appeared. Just thought I'd mention that. Oh, it'd be lovely. Anyway, to become a little more serious and a little less frivolous. In the New Testament, of the 71 times the word friend is used, it's interesting, it is mostly as a greeting to someone. Jesus would often address groups of people as friends. And you'll also find in many of the epistles, the writers address their remarks, dear friends. As an example, if you look at John's letters, because John does it a lot, or Peter's letters, you will often find, don't be surprised, dear friends, or so then, dear friends. The word comes up frequently. Paul's letters are longer, but he often finishes his letters saying, remember me to my friend so-and-so, Tychicus, or so-and-so as being such a good friend to me. And Jesus used it speaking of his followers, which I've mentioned in previous weeks, and I'm going to conclude with that mention again this morning. But before that, I'd like to take a look at perhaps the most notable friendship in the whole Bible, and that's of David and Jonathan. This was down in our schedule long before we decided, well, no, it's probably, but quite independently, I noticed as I was preparing that we were going to dedicate Jonathan and Laura's daughter Imogen this morning. And here's a story about perhaps the best known friendship certainly in the Old Testament, David and Jonathan. Now, in order to talk about that, I need to give you a quick overview of the David story. Now, it takes up a considerable part of the books labelled as 1 and 2 Samuel. I can't read it. If I did, you'd still be listening to the story at 1:30, probably. But I can quickly tell you the story. And it's a great story, and I would encourage you to go away and read it. Some of those Old Testament stories, they're quite long, but they're fascinating things to read. The book of Samuel begins with the story of the birth of Samuel, who became a priest and also the final judge of Israel. Remember, Israel for quite a while was ruled by judges. And in fact, there's a book in the Bible called Judges, which recounts many of those stories. Samuel will be probably the best known and probably the best at the job. He was a very godly man who watched over Israel well. But as Samuel grew old, his sons were expected to take his place. But sadly, they were not like Samuel. They were more interested in their own personal benefits. They couldn't be relied upon to make just decisions. In fact, they took bribes, the Bible says, and pursued dishonest gain. So the elders of Israel came to Samuel and drew his attention to this, though I'm sure he was well aware of it, and also to the fact that Samuel was now old, again, which I've no doubt he was well aware of. And so they said to him that instead of being led by a judge who mediated God's words and will, they wanted a king like the countries around them. A king who would lead them and their armies when they were under attack. Now actually Samuel was angry at this request, not for any personal reason. He didn't particularly see it as a slight on himself, I don't think. But what he did think it was a slight on God. Because he knew how kings behave, which was very different from the whole principle of judges. So when Samuel was angry, he did what he always did. He took it to God. And God told him that ultimately the people were not really rejecting Samuel as their leader. They were actually rejecting God himself. Samuel, even though God said, give them a king, Samuel was still up for trying to persuade them otherwise. He went back to them and painted a very grim picture of what it would be like to be led by a king, having seen the way the neighbouring countries operated. A king would demand taxes from them. He would demand the best of their cattle, the best of their other resources. He would require the best of their horses as well as men to send chariots and charioteers into battle. But the people were not deterred, and God said to Samuel, "Well, give them a king then." There's a long, fascinating story of how Saul was chosen. Saul was a good-looking young man who at first seemed humble and ready to recognize that even if he was king, it was God's commands through Samuel that would be followed. The story is about Saul going looking for some donkeys that had got lost. And it took him a long time, and they were back long before he was. But he was eventually anointed by Samuel as king and accepted by the people. That was what they wanted. They had this king. But after a relatively short time, Saul begins to be full of himself. He disobeys God's instructions through Samuel and then organizes a sacrifice himself rather than waiting for Samuel, who has promised to come for that purpose. That sounds relatively insignificant to you and me, perhaps, but in his day, only the priests were allowed to sacrifice to God. Nobody else was anointed for the purpose. So for a king to choose to do it on his own, simply because Samuel, as far as Saul was concerned, was a bit late. He wasn't later than he'd said, but he left it right to the end of the time. And actually, that wasn't the only thing. I mean, if you read that story, you'd have a little bit of sympathy with Saul, because Saul was getting anxious. He needed to communicate with God. I can see it all, but nevertheless, he did something that he was told not to, and he would have known that that was bang out of order as far as God were concerned. But it gets worse. In 1 Samuel 15, you'll find after another battle, Saul has erected a monument to himself. And this is the key statement. It is reported that the Lord said to Samuel, "I regret that I've made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions." Don't know about you, but I would rather not have God saying of me, "I regret that I asked Graham to do something." As an aside, it is interesting that God gave Saul a chance. You know, it's not because my understanding of God leads me to believe he would have known what Saul would do. Yeah, he chose Saul, and he gave him this chance. And it's not for me to say, but if Saul hadn't made these mistakes, the whole of history might have been different. But Saul did make these mistakes because God gave him that opportunity. But it was some of his choices that disqualified him. And we read on and find that that God's choice is David, and he's anointed on the quiet by Samuel. Samuel was a bit nervous about anointing another king when Saul's still the king. And that is a story you may well know, where David is an unlikely choice because he's right at the list of his brothers. He's got, how many is it, seven? And they're all brought before Samuel, and Samuel looks at the first and he says, "Oh, that must be the one." "No," says God. And he works his way down the list until there aren't any more. So he says to Jesse, "Are there any more?" "Well, there's just David out in the fields looking after the sheep." And it's David that gets the job. You'll remember that. And there are all sorts of ways in which very quickly David finds himself into the court. Particularly, the most notable example, of course, is that he killed the Philistine giant, which is certainly quite noteworthy when you look at the story, because the giant was out there every day for 40 days demanding that somebody was sent to deal with him. Nobody had the bottle to do it, and David, a little lad, does it. Quite remarkable story. And also, some of his musical skills enabled him to find his way into the court. But his success is part of his downfall, because shortly after the giant episode, the Bible actually says it's the women that sang these songs. They started singing songs, and the song went something like this: "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Now, you can imagine Saul just weren't impressed. Well, he wouldn't be, would you? He was the king. He led the army. But somehow or other, very quickly, David was getting 10 times the credit. But the friendship, and that's where I'm coming to, the friendship I draw your attention to is between David and Jonathan. Jonathan was Saul's eldest son, who most would have seen at that time as the future king. That was the established principle in all the other nations, and therefore the expectation was that if Saul had been chosen by God as king and anointed king, the expectation was that Jonathan would be the next king. Now, David had the sense to keep quiet about the fact that he'd been anointed, but quite quickly it begins to be apparent that there's something special about David, because everything goes right for David. And increasingly, everything goes wrong for Saul. The Bible paints an increasingly unfavorable picture of him. That's not the case, though, with Jonathan. Everyone seems to have liked Jonathan. He's a brave young man, confident in God. There's one episode where he, with just his own armor bearer, by the way, although there was a big army out to set the Philistines had set them up so well, there were no blacksmiths left in Israel. So therefore, there was a big army, but all they'd got were farm implements that weren't awfully well sharpened, and there were two swords. Jonathan had one, and Saul had the other, which is a bit limiting when you're going out to battle with an army that's bigger than yourself. Jonathan took his armor bearer with him to see what they could do. Nobody knew they'd gone. He didn't ask Saul's permission. He just nipped off. And there's a story of how Jonathan and his armor bearer, they're looking up to the top of a hill, and on the top of the hill they can see some of the Philistine army. So Jonathan says, this is what we'll do, we'll let them see us, and if they say we're coming down to get you, we know there's a problem. But if they say come on up and get sorted, well, we'll go up and we'll sort them and God will be with us. And so they stepped outside and sort of yoo-hoo. And saw that the Philistines up the top look at two men. And they think, well, what a foolish pair. And they say, come on up here and we'll sort you out. So up they go. And they do a pretty thorough job of sorting out 20 or so soldiers up the top there. But then this is where God comes into it all. Because suddenly the whole Philistine army somehow seems to be fighting with itself. And then does a runner. And the Israel army, despite their inadequacy, they go chasing them. They collect everything that's been left behind and do quite thoroughly well out of it. There's another story that's interesting immediately after it, just showing this lack of wisdom in Saul's part, but I won't go there just now. But you see, what we've got there is Jonathan himself, who never puts a foot wrong. He does not. In fact, he can't believe some of the things that David's saying of his father. He thinks his father tells him everything. So when David says, well, on a couple of occasions, Saul has lobbed a spear at David, which does give you the general impression that he's not too fond of him. And Jonathan can't believe that his father is out to kill David. He says, my father tells me everything. I'll have a word with him. And I'm sure he's going to tell me that there's nothing. And Jonathan puts in a word and says, you know, what is this about? And Saul begins to say to him, well, actually what Saul says, look, can't you see, if David stays around, you won't be the next king, he will be. Fascinating thing is, Jonathan is not fazed by that at all. Doesn't trouble Jonathan one iota, because David is his friend. And increasingly, you'll find little references both from Saul and from Jonathan. They can see quite clearly where the anointing is. They can see David's going to be the next king, whatever. And Saul becomes increasingly afraid of David. In fact, he instructs Jonathan and his attendants to go and kill David. But what Jonathan actually does is he warns David, challenges his father's attitudes, on several occasions sticks up for David, and there's even one occasion where the spear is thrown at Jonathan instead. Saul's not an impressive man by this time, which is a shame, because at the beginning he was. 1 Samuel 18, this is a description of the strength of friendship between David and Jonathan. This is what the Bible says. It says, after David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son. There was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. From that day on, Saul kept David with him and wouldn't let him return home. And Jonathan made a solemn pact with David because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan sealed the pact by taking off his robe and giving it to David, together with his tunic, sword, bow, and belt. Now, actually, again, I suspect the significance there. I suspect that the weapons that the son of the king has and his great robe, they will be indicative of a future king. And he gives them all to David as a pact, as a demonstration of his ongoing friendship. Jonathan, as I said, finds it hard to believe that his father is out to kill his friend David, though he is eventually convinced. And by this time, I'm convinced, you read it, Saul and Jonathan are very clear, David's going to be the next king. But it's like, I suppose it's a bit like the devil. He knows he's beaten, but it doesn't stop him trying to cause us trouble. And in the same way, although Saul knew he was beaten, and eventually it was going to be David rather than Jonathan, he's still trying to see if he can't do something about it. Jonathan, who you would think had more to lose than anyone, he is the one who accepts it. And then he simply strengthens his covenant with David. He has more to say about David. See, as Jonathan sees this, he asks David to reaffirm their covenant of friendship. And he asks David to promise that he will show kindness to Jonathan and the members of his family as long as they live. And that was contrary to the way things were done in his day. If the kingship passed from one family to another, generally speaking, the second family would make sure there were no claimants to the throne in the first family, so they'd just wipe them out. Whereas here's Jonathan saying, he knows what's going to happen, but he says to David, I'm asking you to promise me that, well, he actually says himself, and his family will be treated with kindness. And again, as you read on, you will find that that is exactly what does happen. Jonathan's only remaining relative is found by David later on in the story and is brought into the palace and eats at David's table all the time. As we read on, we find several occasions when David refuses his opportunities to kill Saul and claim what he's been told is to be his. Because as far as he is concerned, Saul is still the Lord's anointed king, and it's up to the Lord and him only when Saul should cease to be king and the throne should be taken by David. David is actually anointed about 25 years before he becomes the king. And Saul, on and off during those years, is chasing David with his army, basically trying to kill David. And there are two very clear occasions when David has clear opportunities to kill Saul. And he refuses to do it. He almost does on one occasion. He chops a piece off Saul's robe just to prove that he was there and could have done it. And then when Saul's on the hill the other side, he gives him a shout. And Saul, at that point, is contrite about what he's done, but doesn't seem to last very long. But at that point, it does. But David is even mortified that he's just chopped a bit of Saul's cloak off, because he thinks he has no right to do that. He's such a respecter of the anointing of God. Eventually, actually, Saul and Jonathan are both killed in the same battle. And David, not immediately, but soon afterwards, is declared king, just of Judah initially, because there were 12 tribes, and two tribes are described at this point as Judah, and the rest are described as Israel. And initially David is just the ruler of Judah, and one of Saul's other sons rules over Israel for a short while. But that really never goes anywhere. And after a very short while, the two come together. It's the time, it's the best time ever for Israel, as far as the Bible stories are concerned. The whole thing is safely under David's rule, and when he does sort a lot of things out. And the end of David's rule and the beginning of Solomon's rule are the two most secure times. Then, unfortunately, it goes wrong. Solomon seems to think he needs a couple of hundred wives. I can't quite understand that, but it's not a good plan. But that's another story. I can't think he'd had time to be friends with those if he got 200, but there you go. Now, I haven't got time to explore why Saul is rejected and David accepted by God. It is fairly complex and complicated because, of course, you and I know David wasn't perfect either. But this morning I want to focus on the friendship between Jonathan and David. You see, at first you can see how it happens. They're alongside one another in the court. They're both in the army. They're probably a similar age. It's quite natural that they should be friends. But as Jonathan begins to see that David threatens his future, that he looks like losing his place as king, it does not change his promised position of love and commitment. That's the really significant thing. Because you could imagine it would change. You will all know, I guess, of stories of people who were friends at one point, and then because there was one of them seemed to have a better opportunity than another, or whatever it might be, somehow the friendship wanes. But this is not so between David and Jonathan. Jonathan in particular is the one who has all to lose but sticks by it. And right at the very, almost at the end of the story, just before the battle that I referred to, once again, Jonathan finds out what Saul is up to do, comes out into a field and warns David, and David has to go. If you'd been in his position, in Jonathan's position that is, and you saw that continued friendship with David almost certainly threatened your future, how would you have chosen? Of course, we can't answer that, can we? These sorts of questions we can never answer. When you've read the end of that story, you think, yeah, I'd do that. But probably we wouldn't. It is a remarkable example of friendship. And so, just to take that example of friendship, which I want to call a kingdom example of friendship, it's dependent on what God says. And I just want to pick out four or five items that I think are keys of that friendship that we can apply to our friendships. First of all, Jonathan always believed in and spoke well of David. Believed in him, spoke well of him. He wanted to believe well of his dad as well, if you notice. But he was not swayed by what his father said. He believed the best of his friend, and time again he spoke well of him, even though he risked the wrath of his father. Something quality about friendship where there's that sort of confidence. If we have friends, let's make sure we continue always to believe in them, even when somebody else is saying something else. And if there is some doubt, well, we should be going to them, not believing anything other. And we should always be found speaking well of our friends. Again, not listening if there's something ill being said. Our recollection, our understanding, our commitment of these friends means we speak well. A second thing, which I suppose is probably just another way of saying the same thing, is loyalty. He remained loyal to his friend, whatever. He demonstrated that loyalty by giving his friend his cloak, sword and belt, which, as I said, I think it's almost as though he was saying, I recognize that you're going to the one who rules after my father, not me, but I'm still demonstrating this loyalty to you. He took risks for his friend's sake. There's something about Jonathan. He took a number of risks for his friend's sake and for the sake of this friendship. He didn't need to do it, but there was something about this friendship that meant he was willing, in his case, it was even going as far as risking his life. But sometimes, out of friendship, we need to stand firm for the sake of someone who is our friend and we're speaking well of them, even if something is turning against them. We need to be certain that our friends are loyal to us and we are to them. And that we might even go so far as to take risks because of that. There's something else that I think friendship does. I think it goes beyond friendship, but friendship does. One prefers someone else. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, if I say you're preferring somebody else, it means you give them first place. You give them the better opportunity. And there is no doubt that Jonathan put David's well-being way, way ahead of his own. And there's that sense. And a quality of friendship is that we prefer others. In fact, if we skip back to what we've been talking about a couple of weeks ago, when we talk about Jesus said we should love our neighbours, actually, we finish up feeling that we actually ought to be, we're ready to prefer everyone above ourselves. There ought to be space for others. And then, There's something interesting about friendship. You do expect something of your friends, don't you? You expect that similar treatment. Because of their promises to each other, Jonathan felt that he, having promised everything to David, he could ask David in return to promise to him that he would remain kind to Jonathan and his family all the days. And if you look back to what we were saying about loving our neighbour, I just want you to spend, I'll just give you a couple of minutes, just want you to spend a moment thinking of your key friendships. I'd like you to thank God for what you value in them. Think of the two-way loyalty, of the trust between you and your friends, of your confidence of how you know they will speak well of you and you will speak well of them. Let's just, in a moment, give thanks to God for those friendships and almost review them so that if any of your friendships don't quite come up to the mark, then in that quiet time, determine to make adjustments to strengthen the friendships you have and will have in the future. Okay, just take a couple of minutes in quiet prayer. If in the quiet you've thought of something about you and some of your friends, don't forget it when you leave here. Make a note somewhere that there's something worth saying or doing that will improve your strong friendships. Finally, I'm just going to remind you of something Jesus said of his followers, just to double underline this word friends. And then perhaps the band will come back and lead us in one more song. This is the passage I mentioned right at the beginning when I was talking about Jesus using the term friends. This is found in John's Gospel. And this is what Jesus said. I've loved you, this was talking to his followers. I've loved you the way my Father has loved me. Make yourselves at home in my love. If you keep my commands, you will remain intimately at home in my love. That's what I've done, kept my Father's commands and made myself at home in his love. I've told you these things for a purpose, that my joy might be your joy and your joy wholly mature. This is my command, love one another the way I loved you. This is the very best way to love. Put your life on the line for your friends. You are my friends when you do the things I command you. I'm no longer calling you servants because servants don't understand what their master's thinking and planning. No, I've named you friends, says Jesus, because I've let you in on everything I've heard from the Father. If I'm going to summarize friendship, in the end, the absolute best of all is the fact that Jesus said to you and to me, we're his friends, because he's let us in on the secrets. Perhaps another definition, friends know you. Friends know what you're thinking. They know what you like. But isn't it amazing to think that you and I can be described as the friends of God himself? So friends, this morning, let's be friends of one another and let's be friends of God.